So again, welcome everyone, and we'll see how the phones go, hoping that this cell phone that I'm using because of the storm, having put down the telephone lines here, will work for us. So this is September 12, 2009, and the topic for this teleconference is Meditation for Three Voices, which is Pathwork Guide Lecture 182. Now, I referenced the Chapter 4 in The Undefended Self, which focuses on the child, adult ego, and soul selves, because that is presented similar to the Meditation for Three Voices suggests that we work with things. So the two seemed like a very, very good marriage. It seemed like a really good explanation of a lot of different concepts in one chapter. I have posted a table from The Undefended Self with the papers on the internet, and later today I will post a PowerPoint presentation that has a lot of other information from The Undefended Self. So someone asked last night if they needed to purchase it, but that's a personal choice. But what I wanted to let you know was that what The Undefended Self does is in one chapter it might discuss 10-15 lectures. But the concepts in those lectures, you can read different lectures and get the same concepts. So it's just a matter of personal choice, whether you choose to read the lectures or you want to read that particular book. So I want to back up a second, and I want to pick up some information from the Higher Self, Lower Self, and Mask, which is Pathwork Guide Lecture 14. And the reason for that is that we're using it with the Meditation for Three Voices. So the concepts of the mask, in particular. So starting with the mask, meaning the part of our persona that we show to everyone. Okay? What the mask is it's a defense, really. It's a way of being with the world that will assure that we get approved of, that will make us feel comfortable and allow interaction, to not get criticized, to not get rejected, to try to fit in with everyone else. And so it's just like putting on a costume. In fact, the clothes that you're wearing at this moment are part of your mask. When people have a hard time grasping the concept, I suggest sometimes that they change clothes with the person next to them. And they'll look at that person and go, ugh, wrong color, wrong style, wrong shape, wrong fit. For all these sound like very minor and superficial details, but they're not. We present ourselves to the world in a certain way, and the choice of our clothing is very key to what we think of ourselves and what we want to communicate. Now, that's the mask part. But the mask is created by a process known as an image, which is, of course, another lecture, a larger reality, and we covered this about 6 or 9 months ago in the discussion on the idealized self-image. The mask is made up of images which are made up from generalizations. And you keep going down the line and say, well, where does this all come from? And it comes from a painful experience in the past where you experience rejection or upset or disharmony, and you make a generalization about why that happened. But we're going so far back in history that we're talking about a child level of consciousness. So basically, a lot of our images are made up by children who are 2, 3, and 4 years old. Hmm. Now, the child consciousness has a massive amount of positive energy. The child consciousness holds our creativity. It holds our joy. It's the lifeblood of our being. And child consciousness is limited. It's limited because the child only has so much information presented to it. And as the information comes in, the child has to interpret this energy with a very, very short or non-existent history. So it's like going into a foreign country and reading a newspaper about certain events and being asked your opinion on them. Well, you probably don't know what to say because you don't know who the players are. You don't know what the situation really means within that culture. You don't know what's been going on for the past 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years, 5 centuries in that country that would make a certain news article hit the majority of people in that country a certain way, and yet you might be totally unaffected by it. On the other hand, you could be affected by it, and everybody says, that's just the way it is, don't worry about it. Mm. For a child, imagine a child in a home situation, and the child has no history to work with. It doesn't have the thousand-year bookshelf of books telling it who people are, why they act in a certain way, why the culture does certain things. All they know is, mommy screams when I do this, or mommy looks at me critically when I act a certain way. And the fact that mommy is wrong or shallow or having a bad day or a thousand other factors that could affect mom, the child does not know this, and the child really has no means to figure this out and no incentive to figure this out. The child just wants to be safe. We just want to please our parents. We want to get our dinner. We want to play with our toys and go to bed. That's really all we want. So the child takes the information that's coming in about itself, because it's self-centered, and it makes generalizations based on a very, very, very limited perception. And once those generalizations are made, and they bounce that back and forth a few times, the child feels they've gotten the picture. They have figured this out. And it may not ever come up again. If it's a minor matter, it may never rise to the surface again. They have simply learned how to handle a given situation. But when it comes to a larger set of circumstances, like an image of what a girl should be, or what a boy should be, or how my family reacts with the other people in the town or village, these can be very, very complicated. So this is why in pathwork two terms are used. One is the mask, and that is just the appearance. That's a superficial appearance. But the other is an idealized self-image, which is a very, very large number of experiences that you may no longer be aware of that activate and help you keep up an appearance or an image between you and the rest of the world. Now, the reason I went into a lot of detail on the mask like that is the other aspect of the mask and the idealized self-image is that it's always talking about the past. It always refers to pain or embarrassment or humiliation that happened back then. So when you are in your mask, when you're in your idealized self-image of being the good girl or the helpful person, to some degree, you are not in present reality. You're really in the past. Okay? So you have a child that is doing the very best it knows how with limited perceptions, and the child has not yet developed the second phase of this triad, and that is the adult ego, the ego at all, much less the adult ego. So I'm going to read a quote from Pathwork Lecture 132, The Function of the Ego. And it says, the child at birth does not yet possess an ego. Without the ego, it is possible to perceive the message from the real self quite clearly. But without the ego, the meaning of the message must be distorted. The child experiences the longing for utter perfection, utter power, and utter pleasure. But in the undeveloped ego, these desires are not only illusory, but selfish and destructive. Now, Lecture 132 talks about the need for an ego. Pathwork teaches that ego is not an evil thing, it just is. It's a structure. And the structure can support the child it can help the child get what it wants. But what the child starts off with is a largely undifferentiated mind. It just doesn't know what the priorities might be. It is spontaneous and creative, which is wonderful. But very often, spontaneity and creativity will get you in trouble. So it's bound eventually to do something that isn't quite kosher in its family environment. At that point, get called down, and perhaps gruffly by an impatient adult. Okay? Children live in the moment utterly and absolutely. They really have, they have to learn a sense of past and future. And the past is a lot easier for them to get than the future. And part of the job of the adult ego is to extrapolate into the future. For instance, a goal that they want, figure out how to get there and what they have to do, and keep that goal in mind while they're performing certain tasks. But the child with a rather shaky sense of past and future can get very, very lost, and therefore what is here and now is the most important thing for them. Children work with an automatic instinctual response that focuses on their physical and their emotional needs. They're not working on a mental, intellectual, will, desire level. And even though they have access to the creative part of themselves, that is different from self-actualization. So while the child has all the raw materials, they are not yet developed. Now, when the child acts out and the adults in its life put pressure on it to control itself, I'm going to use the example of toilet training. It can be difficult to toilet train a child because the adults are eager for the child to learn this task. It means a lot to them, especially after a year or two. But the child, it's a muscular control that may or may not be easy for a particular child. So the child is doing something natural and normal, and it's getting in trouble with its parents and causing distress and grief to its parents. And when the child tries to perform at a level beyond its capacity, it can strain and create tensions inside the body that can be there for decades to come. And realistically, the parent only knows, oh, the child finally got it, without realizing what the child may have done to have accomplished a task. So in the example of toilet training, if you toilet train a child too early, you can disturb its functions because a child may have to spend a lot more effort trying to control its bowels and bladder than an adult realizes. So they're scooping up energy from their body and tensing their body, trying to control a situation that they are simply not mature enough to control. And over the years, they may not relax these muscles, and they wind up with body tensions as adults because of this process. When a child is spontaneous and creative and an adult shushes it and says, shh, don't do that. Don't dance now. Don't sing now. Don't be happy now. Wait till later. The child really doesn't know what else to do but suck it in. Pull it in. And what is happening, what I'm trying to build here is a kind of a kinesthetic for you, where the child is taking its wonderful spontaneity and creativity and having to bundle it up and lock it up and pack it in and put it someplace because it cannot freely express it. Mm-hmm. But what it can express is not really who it is. It's what its parents want it to be and the mask that it can meet. So from very early on, a child develops a mask of being good and polite, and also a repressed layer of energy where they are trying to control their impulses, but they aren't really understanding why they have to be controlled. And what happens here, if you can feel this like a geological event under the surface, They're restrained to creativity, and the creativity is just bubbling around like magma, you know, getting a little bit more impatient and upset. That all you need is for some of that to be negative. And the child begins to get a mixture inside itself of not only the positive aspects of child consciousness, but the negative aspects of child consciousness. Now at that point, that's a great recipe for a soup that we name the lower self of the child consciousness. And this is where children get into trouble. Because when they finally release that energy, once again, they are not quite aware of what it is, what has happened. They're not psychologists. They don't exactly know what's going on. And when they release this energy and put it forward, it's usually a mixture of positive and negative energies and needs and wants. And anyway, they make quite a mess on the floor, and we yell at them even more. So they scoop it up and put it back in, and the process begins. So from the level of child consciousness, this is where the mask of the child helps to create intensify the lower self of the child. And again, a child, because it's not self-actualized and it doesn't really know what questions to ask, doesn't really know how to access cleanly the divine part of itself. So again, it has all the materials, but it doesn't know how to use them. And if it's not being raised in a very intuitive and creative home that's highly attuned to its needs, then what results is a repression of energy that builds up over time. Now, I've spent a while going into that because in most of the time when we do what we call the three-chair or three-voice meditation, we're dealing with the destructive part of the child. Now, why would we do that? Because the part of you, the child consciousness part of you, that works cleanly and clearly, that moves straight from the divine right out into the universe, doesn't need any help. The part of you that wants to be looked at, that wants to do all this spiritual work, that is walking around reading self-help books, that part of you is what is termed the destructive child, where there's good and positive and negative energies mixed together, and you may have literally lost your roadmap to which is which and how it got there. Now, who is looking at this situation? Your adult ego. So let me go for a second into the second aspect of what we're going to be looking at, and that is the adult ego. So from lecture 158, which is the ego's cooperation with or obstruction of the real self, quite a title in itself, the guide lists the purpose of the adult ego. And he says, the ego must know that it is only a servant to the greater being within. Its main function is to deliberately seek contact with the greater self. It must know its position. It must know that its strength, possibility, and function are to seek contact, to decide for it, to request the help for the greater self, to establish contact permanently. Now, the functions or the qualities of the adult ego include the ability to make conscious choices, the ability to be self-reflective, the ability to bear up under frustration, to work towards future goals, to be responsible, to be orderly, which may sound a little superficial, but it's not. Being orderly comes down to, if you can't find your keys, you can't get in your car and make the appointment. Being orderly, to some degree or another, helps you be responsible. These things all interconnect. The adult ego also allows you to be autonomous and independent. by being able to use the faculty to see ahead, to plan, to figure things out, so that you can take care of yourself to the degree you choose to. Notice that there are no specific values regarding this. We're allowed to do anything we want with these capabilities. And one of the things that we may choose to do is to support our child consciousness. Now the reality is we may choose not to support our child consciousness. So perhaps you can see that depending on where the child's energy went, if that child's energy turned a little noxious, and every time it sees the light of day, trouble results, as the ego develops into an adult form, it's not going to be too thrilled about the idea of this energy coming forward. How does this energy help the adult ego have all these positive qualities stay positive? If every time their kid sees the light of day, trouble results, our natural impulse is to put the kid back in the closet. Now, I've used this analogy before. When you lock the kid up for 10 or 20 years, and every once in a while you peek in and say, "How you doing in there?" you're going to find a more and more miserable being who is going to be more prone to acting out and creating problems rather than more docile and more willing to take anything you want to hand it. So what we have here is a vicious cycle. Now, if you had a child that had the ability to be free, whose energy could move, who was met by the world with smiles and delight, as the adult ego develops, the adult ego might decide to give the child more opportunities, more alternatives for their creativity. The adult might try to find a job or a career where its child qualities could really shine. These are the choices made by the adult ego that have tremendous ramifications on how tight and solid the mask is to keep that kid in, on how noxious and or positive or negative the child energy is. And the way we diagram this is in concentric circles with the mask on the edge, like a great big orange rind, and the lower self surrounding it, and the higher self or real self inside the center. And the reason we diagram it like that is that if the mask is porous and releases the child energy and allows input, and the child energy moves freely and stays positive and washes itself basically of the negative energy, then the higher self, the divine self, has a wonderful opportunity to interact with both layers and to be more present in the world. But if that system is closed tight, it traps the lower self. So that's a little bit of a discussion about the child consciousness and why we work with the destructive child and the adult ego. Now, the higher self, real self, sometimes it's actually hard to explain. People say, well, what is that? Well, it doesn't wear a hat, and it doesn't wear sandals, and it doesn't dance. So, gee, what is the higher self? Basically, the higher self matures in terms of coming forward more, being more in the world, through the child and the adult ego, into one term for it is a transpersonal level. This is the term that Susan uses in her book. And in the child, the higher self shows up in the spontaneity and creativity, the shining of the divine energy. In the adult ego, the higher self shows up in the ability to be a wise and loving parent and teacher, in the wisdom of the conscious choices, and the depth of the self-reflection. Now, once you get up to the higher levels, the higher self might act out in terms of helping the organism, helping the human being have positive soul directions with an intent to unify. Unify in itself with all its parts, unify with other people, and eventually unification with God. The higher self also contains the personal soul gifts. And from the higher self comes the altruistic desire to serve. So there we have the child consciousness, the adult ego, and the higher self or real self. Now, a lot of these terms are interchangeable, and people have preferences for one over the other. But, you know, whatever you're comfortable with. Now, I'm going to turn at this point to the three voices, and let me explain why the term is so messy. The actual name of the lecture is The Process of Meditation. But within the lecture, it gives suggestions on how to work with these particular three aspects of ourselves. And so it's become known as the Meditation for Three Voices. And then as we use it as teachers and process groups and so forth, one of the easiest ways to do this is to sit somebody down on a couch or where there are three seating positions of some kind, three chairs, and to give them props or different colored pillows so that the human mind and the visualization can engage in the game of this process and be more able to go there on a feeling level. So it winds up being called the three-chair meditation. So this is where the progression of the name comes from, and you'll find them being used interchangeably. Now, I find that the easiest way to do this meditation is to take a simpler subject than child consciousness, adult ego, and real self. Those are pretty heavy concepts for a beginner. So, sorry. So one way to start this would be if you could work on hearing the different voices of the higher self, lower self, and mask. Now, at the end of the chapter, Susan Thesenga has a little exercise for this, which I will read off, and she calls it a meditation for three voices. And here's what it would look like if you just did it in terms of personal writing and reflection. Now, when I suggest that you write something down, that's because it's easy to speak like that, but a lot of people just think it through, which is fine. Some people, I've known people who speak this into a tape recorder, totally up to the individual and how they interact with themselves and their own voice and writing and etc. So when you hear me talk about this, be creative on your own part and allow yourself to do what feels right for you, what fits into your spiritual practice. So what she suggests in this exercise is, number one, to figure out what you want to look at. And if you don't have something already in mind. So if you really say, well, I want to look at higher self, lower self, and mask, but I don't really know what to work on. The way to gain some material for yourself is to keep a daily review for 5 days, to note any disharmonies that appear on each day. And then at the end of 5 days, during this 5 days, to use a sheet of paper, and on one side describe the disharmonious event, and I'm using the fancy word disharmonious because some things that bother us just kind of niggle at us. Sometimes the things that bother us a great deal just are just below the surface. They're not flagrant. We wouldn't want to call them negative. We really don't even want to call them a problem. But the word disharmonious tends to resonate with people. You cannot like something and not truly understand why and feel uncomfortable with it and want to deal with it without it necessarily having gone negative. So using a sheet of paper, describe the disharmonious event of the day or the several disharmonious events as briefly as you can. Don't make this into a novel. And on the other side, describe the thoughts or feelings that you had on the other side. If there are 5 incidents per day, write down 5 different events and 5 different sets of thoughts and feelings. After 5 days, review what you've written and see if you can discern in there a voice. A voice of child consciousness, if that's where you want to work on it. The voice of the lower self, a negative, angry voice, a destructive voice, or even the voice of the adult ego. The adult ego feeling distressed. Because although I listed off some wonderful qualities about the adult ego is not a candidate for sainthood. Okay? The adult ego has a lot of negative qualities that it can fall into. For instance, the adult ego can become very calculating. It can become materialistic, where it depends on things instead of substance, instead of energy, instead of camaraderie or faith or trust. It can become uncomfortable with all that and turn and try to go into proof or materialism, having written agreements or contracts, having everything written down, having possessions to make it feel like it's accomplished something in the day, week, or month. The ego can become overly mental, where it's constantly trying to figure things out. And the truth is that a lot of life cannot necessarily be figured out. The adult ego is certainly not invulnerable to having narrow interests. Now, whereas the child, I know I'm digressing for a second, whereas the child may only see mine or yours, the adult ego may see much more distant into the future. It may see a series of events. But it decides that that would be in its self-interest. And it pursues that course without regard for other people. Now, at some point, the adult ego may get the sense that it's on the wrong track. And this is where you may want to you may decide to work with your adult ego, because if the adult ego is not porous and being, as I read from the lecture quote, a servant to the process of your growth and development, and instead it's trying to throttle it so it can feel safe and secure, then the adult ego is the aspect of you that you may wish to focus on. So at the end of 5 days, when you have added all these things up and looked at them, and you decide what you want to work on, that's where we were headed. Sorry, I'm losing my place here. So you write down, draw, or just sit quietly and simply experience the thoughts and feelings of the child, if that's who are you relating to, or the adult ego, if that's what you are relating to. And allow yourself a few moments of free expression without judgment. Now, things get pretty complicated here, because it is the adult ego that allows the free expression. So you can see where this is very handy in working with a child, where your ego can say, we're going to sit right down right now, and I'm going to give you time to express yourself. But if the adult ego is the area of yourself that's in distress, there may be another part of you, your higher self, that speaks to it and says, we need to take some time. We need to sit down and look at this. You're tired, fatigued, and distressed. and we need to try to find out why. And that is one of the things that with love and truth, the higher self, real self part of you can offer to these other voices. So the first step is to decide what you want to look at and write things down a few times a day for 5 days. The second step is to sit down and write, try to figure out what this is all about and take a look at it. The third step is to try to bring the positive adult ego into dialogue with the inner child. Now, we're assuming that we're working with the child at this point. And the adult ego would act as a good parent. So the adult ego has the capacity to be caring and objective and yet confronting with love when necessary. And if you're working by yourself, Susan suggests that you write out this dialogue, keeping it as brief as possible so that you can go over it several times. To write out the dialogue, to listen carefully to the part of you that needs to speak up, that is in distress. And she says, only when the adult ego can listen with total openness and compassion can the child feel free to speak. So keep in mind during this process that what you are probably looking for is a part of you that has been suppressed by another part of you. And for it to come out, even in your own room with a sheet of paper and a pencil, for it to come out, it needs a supportive environment. We all need that kind of supportive environment, especially when we reach down into the hurt and vulnerable parts of us. And that's what this work is about. It may not feel that way when you're angry or frustrated, but the reasons for anger and frustration are usually very tender places in you that were not addressed or cared for, both by others, but also by yourself. And to find out what's going on, to elicit the truth from yourself, you need to believe that you can hear yourself without instant judgment. You may have judgment, but there's a difference between saying, realizing you having judgment and having an energy that swiftly moves into saying, I'm bad, this is wrong. That's what you want to contain. And then the fourth step of the exercise, and these are, they're in a handout presentation, again, that will be on the website tomorrow night. The fourth step, still focusing on the original disharmony, to invoke the positive soul level, to basically go into a level of meditation and ask for guidance, direction, and blessing. And then when you have, at this point, three parts. Now, once again, we're talking about a specific situation where we're working with a section of child consciousness. So we have child consciousness. We have adult ego that's holding space. And we have a larger part of us which can support and hold the process. And by doing this, even on your own, I challenge you that you would be surprised at that this can be very, very effective.